books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and this week's show is recorded live on location at the Wigtown Book Festival. Baker's Dozen is a festival within a festival of words and food, guest curated by Conaich MacLeod, the Hebridean baker, who we'll talk to in a moment. Cookbooks don't generally work well in audio, so we'll talk to two authors who were part of the Baker's Dozen and their books about food. First up, Penn Vogler, who is a food historian and author of the Sunday Times bestseller Scoff. She was there with her new book, Stuffed. And we'll talk to philosopher Julian Baggini, author of How the World Thinks, who was there with his new book, How the World Eats, a global food philosophy, which will be out in audio soon. All that plus the books of your life from last week's guest, Gareth Brown, coming up on today's Read On. At the Wigtown Book Festival this year was Conaich MacLeod, also known as the Hebridean Baker. He was the host of a cookbook festival within the Wigtown Book Festival, and I'll talk to him about that in a moment. But first, let's hear from his first book, simply called The Hebridean Baker, Recipes and Wee Stories from the Scottish Islands. It's read by Conaich himself.
Close your eyes. What is your picture of the Outer Hebrides? Walking along a deserted beach on a wild stormy day? Climbing to the top of a heather-strewn hill with a happy wee dog by your side? Sipping a dram of whiskey at a ceilidh as a Gaelic song is being sung? Or sitting by your aunt's warm stove, waiting for a cake to come out of the oven? For me, it has been all these things, and more, and they have inspired every page of this book. Falche, I'm the Hebridean baker. My name is Conaich MacLeod, and I'm from the island of Lewis, the furthest north of the Outer Hebrides of Scotland. My love of baking is only equalled by the love I have for the island where I was born, which made writing this cookbook a very special and humbling experience. I feel like I'm living my dream, sharing recipes and stories from the islands with you. The Hebrides is a larder like no other, with some of the best whisky, seafood, meat, and homegrown produce you'll ever be lucky enough to enjoy. And I'm hoping, whether you are in Brooklyn, Vancouver, or Perth, you'll discover a wee slice of the Hebrides among these pages.
Yeah, I've been invited to host a cookbook festival within Wigtown Book Festival, and what an amazing adventure it's been.
What sort of events have we had?
A real eclectic bunch, from classic cookbooks and baking demonstrations to insights into food history and also kind of different cultures, ones that focus on Scottish food, Indian food, more slanted on English history. It really has been eclectic, but the crowds have just loved it.
Best of all, I'd love it if this book made you do three things. One, come and visit the Hebrides. When the late First Minister of Scotland, Donald Dewar, first visited Lewis, he met an elderly woman working on her croft in Uig on the west coast of the island. He asked her if she felt remote. She lifted her head and said to him, "Remote from where?" "Yes, we might be far away, but we do not feel remote. We are part of our community." And maybe I'm biased, but for me, here is the most beautiful place on earth. And to entice you, I am going to tell you stories about our islands, its culture, language, traditions and legends.
And what about yourself? What happened at your event?
So as the Hebridean baker, I've been releasing my fourth cookbook, the Scottish cookbook. And really for me, I use food as a conduit about talking about the culture, the storylines, the myths and legends, and the language of the Hebrides as well. And We had quite a laugh, to be honest with you. A great crowd, and it's been fantastic. Maybe introducing a destination and a style of cookery that people might not know too much about, but the interest is just fantastic.
For all of you who travel to the islands, you will go home with a memory you will never forget. Be it standing in the centre of a 5,000-year-old stone circle, hearing the Gaelic language spoken for the first time, unrolling that perfect yard of Harris tweed, eating the freshest lobster you've ever had, being spun around by a burly man in a kilt at your first ceilidh dance, or walking through one of our beautiful villages, wondering if your ancestors took the same path. So, now is the time to let your story with the Hebrides begin.
You read the audio version of your first book, I believe. How was that process?
Do you know what? I hadn't realised that it wasn't that common a thing to do audiobooks for cookbooks. But I think it really played into what I absolutely love about my cookbooks is, yes, it's filled with delicious recipes, absolutely. But I share the stories of the myths, the legends, the folklore, and family stories as well from the island. I did also voice some of the recipes. And I think the thing that made me chuckle the most was somebody wrote afterwards that their favourite line was, well, I think they said, come for his cakes, stay for the way he says, cream your butter.
Slow down. The Danes created hygge, which we can understand as a feeling of contentment. Snuggling up by the fire, wrapped in a warm blanket. Sipping tea from your favourite mug while a storm rages outside. It is a lifestyle that feels wholesome and nourishing. Created from a set of ingredients that include togetherness, presence and comfort. So what is the Gaelic word for hygge? Well, maybe it's not a direct translation, but the word I would use is blas, which means warmth, kindliness and contentment. There is a saying in Gaelic, beri blas ar luas. It translates as there is a time for everything. What is my perfect day of blas? Taking a walk down to the shoreline and hearing the sea roar. Looking out the window to see Peter digging in the garden, planting his vegetables. Pulling all the cookbooks out from the bookshelves and deciding what I'm going to bake. Then sitting by the stove, learning the tune of an old Gaelic song. Why don't you try it for a day? Maybe blas could become the way of life you were looking for.
The Hebridean Baker, written and read by Cánaigh MacLeod, is available commercially now. I met Cánaigh MacLeod at the Wigtown Book Festival as he was hosting an event featuring author Penn Vogler. Penn is a critically acclaimed food historian and was at Wigtown to talk about SCOFF, a fascinating social food history of Britain, bringing together evidence from cookbooks, literature, artworks and social records, tracing the changing fortunes of the food we encounter today. And also to talk about her new book, Stuffed, a tale of feast and famine, and of the traditions, the ideas and the laws which have fed or starved the nation. We'll have a chat about both books in a moment, but both Stuffed and SCOFF are read by Emma Gregory. Let's start with SCOFF.
SCOFF, verb, to jeer at. SCOFF, noun, food, a meal. The Chambers Dictionary. 2 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall, I was teaching English in a small town in what was then Czechoslovakia. The people of Liberec, 20 miles north of Prague, were blinking in the light of new problems and freedoms, such as the right to learn English and travel. None of my kind and respectful adult students had had the chance to discover Britain or any part of the West for themselves, and they were courteously eager to learn everything my 22-year-old self could impart. When I came to the lesson on British food in my TEFL book, I was a little apprehensive. Would all the book's talk of roast beef and fresh vegetables make it look as if I was crowing, I wondered, to people who'd been stuck behind the fried cheese and pickled cabbage curtain? and where I had seen no fresh fruit and vegetables in the whole of the winter months I had been there. I needn't have worried. They all already knew for a fact that British cooking was the laughing stock of Europe. No matter what I said about home cooking, local ingredients, international cuisines, I could see that they were having none of it. In spite of my inability to grasp the Czech language, I could tell a room full of scoffing students when I saw one.
I was thinking about scoff for 10 years before I managed to write it, but I was really interested in this question of how our fairly universal obsession in Britain with social class, how that changed what we eat. And, of course, it changes almost everything, because if you think about bread, for example, white bread was something that everybody aspired to eat until it was really common. And then everybody talked about now that being as common as bread, and, you know, common as sliced bread, and white bread is something that's not considered kind of classy any longer. So that's one tiny example of how all the food we eat changes over time and how we kind of judge each other in England and probably Scotland, you know, Wales and Ireland, about what's in our shopping basket and where that judgment comes from.
Admittedly, our international standing in the kitchen has, historically, never been good. No British chefs have given their names to the great dishes of cream, truffle and potato. The fame of British cakes tends to be domestic, unlike the continental tort families of Sacher, Linzer. It has been, right up to our current culinary obsessiveness, a centuries-old belief of our continental friends, and many Brits themselves, that the British are insufficiently obsessed with food, and that a bit more European-style passion would bring us more enjoyable meals, a more functional family life, better health, and fewer laughable cafes and restaurants. However, one classic British obsession has given us a huge stake in the business of food, and that is social class. In a country where even letters have a choice of first or second class in the postal system, how much more ideal is eating, with its innate social function and attendant rituals, as a way of firing up rivalry, envy, and social unease, and conveying the niceties of where we all sit on the social ladder?
And things like fish and chips were seen as the food for the poor.
Fish and chips are really interesting because they started off being very smelly, the oil to fry, and so they were kept in industrial areas next to factories. That's why you have fish and chip Fridays, because that's when you get your wage packet. And they were, and until they kind of cleaned up their act a little bit, but there was also a big kind of PR campaign done by the Fish Friars Association to make them seem not for the poor. And in the Second World War, Winston Churchill said that they were the good companions, and they'd given people, you know, for people bombed out of their houses, couldn't cook, that the fish and chip shop was where you got a hot meal from. And they had a big image change over the time.
Let's have a listen.
How we serve food and how we eat it, our table manners, what we call our meals, and what time we have them, all this has been a source of immense fascination to Brits for longer than our European friends have been taking sideswipes at grey mincemeat and lumpy custard. Everything we believe we choose to eat actually comes to us with years, often centuries, of value-laden social history. Our decisions about what we like and how we regard food are influenced by our parents, their parents, our peers, but also by a long history and a wide network of social and political pressures. Foods have slid up and down the social scale, been invented or disappeared completely. Most Brits could read a shopping basket as though it were a character sketch: Golden Shred or Oxford Marmalade, Taifu or Earl Grey, Custard Creams or Florentines, Kingsmill or Sourdough, Stir-fry Veg or Pot Noodle, Battery or Free Range, Donuts or Chelsea buns. By the same token, how we behave at home isn't simply a matter of personal choice, but a series of clues about our background and upbringing. Whether you sit round the table as a family, how you push your peas onto your fork, whether you serve food such as wild garlic or grouse that hasn't come from a shop, all these are clues to who you are, as much as what sociolinguists would call the social markers in your speech.
Now, you were at Wigtown Book Festival to talk about your new book, Stuffed. Tell us about that.
Stuffed is about the kind of fairly knotty question at the heart of everything we eat in Britain, which is who is responsible for it. So stuffed means you're stuffed in a good way, you've had Christmas dinner, you're feeling pleasantly full, or you're stuffed because you've come to the end of the road. You've got no good choices left, you are stuffed. And I thought there's, in between those two words, meanings of the word stuffed, is a whole kind of arc of people's experience. And if you're stuffed because you've got no good choices, who then is going to take responsibility for you? That was the question. And it's a question that has kind of dogged us really throughout hundreds of years of history. And I just wanted to look at what the way that people thought about it historically to help us think about it now.
The business of this book is to try to figure out how people at the time made sense of their changing world. What was going on in the fields, kitchens, shops, dining rooms, debating chambers of the country when we elected to give rice pudding to children? How did we come to love and then lose pumpkin pie? Why did we exchange carp and herring for cod and chips? And was the love of Yorkshire pudding and roast beef universal? Hard times have forced people to fight for or argue over their food rights and responsibilities since the earliest historical and archaeological records. As with the rest of the world, in Britain, these disagreements have been brought into sharp focus by global economic, security and health crises. When, in the coronavirus pandemic that took hold in early 2020, the footballer Marcus Rashford campaigned for the government to extend a meal voucher scheme into the school holidays for hard-hit families, the House of Commons was, once again, the site of a debate about food entitlements and obligations. While the Shadow Education Secretary, Kate Green, said, "It is the government's responsibility to ensure that children do not go hungry," a survey showed that just under two-thirds of the population agreed, Brendan Clark-Smith, a Tory MP and former teacher, countered with, "Where is the slick PR campaign encouraging absent parents to take some responsibility for their children? I do not believe in nationalising children. Instead, we need to get back to the idea of taking responsibility," by which he meant individual parental responsibility. These two opposing positions have given rise to debates over how to feed ourselves that have enraged and galvanised people in the House of Commons, in forests, on farms and common land, in local and manorial courts, in front of jails holding poachers, on the quayside, in churches and village halls, in the officers' mess and military commissariat, for over 1,000 years.
I asked this question at another talk. I'd be interested to hear your answer to it, but how long do you think it will be until we can go into a supermarket and buy lab-grown meat?
Nobody knows is the honest answer to it, because it's very difficult to grow lab-grown meat because it needs absolute... It needs to be completely clean and it needs to have no germs whatsoever. So you need either to kind of have this extraordinary level of cleanliness, but also antibiotics that you don't really want to be eating in your food. And so until they've got over this kind of these big technical hurdles, it's just not going to be on anybody's plate very soon. And if they get over those technical hurdles, it might be. Or it might be that, like GM foods in Britain, there's a massive kind of, like, when, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, there's a massive kind of revulsion against it. And we all say, no, this is not for us.
Now, a few years back, I transcribed an old recipe book that had turtle soup, not mock turtle soup, actual turtle soup that told you how to peel the turtle. It had brain cakes. Do you think some foods have died out for a very good reason?
Well, I mean, things like turtles, yeah, they die out because of the availability of them. You know, there just aren't enough turtles to go around. But also, turtle soup was really associated with kind of high Victoriana. And then a particular type of dining, a particular type of etiquette. And then when people moved on from Victorian times, they didn't want to have anything to do with it. And, you know, and so they celebrated a different kind of dining, less French, more kind of local, more sort of English, for example. And so things like that will come in and out of fashion. But also they'll be, you know, they'll like turtles. they'll go out of fashion because, you know, it's just not that much availability. Mm. Yeah, I think you're right. There's some things shouldn't probably be eaten.
A hill farmer on the upland commons, or a brewer, a baker, an artisan cheesemaker. The supermarket with aisle after aisle, or the corner store with a few rickety shelves. The cafe serving a full English fry-up. The pizzeria with a child-friendly margarita. These are the businesses that contract with the community to provide food, and that must survive or thrive according to what their local customers, or the whole nation, believe is important. Cheap, convenient, local, sustainable, scalable. These values change over the centuries, but some become so embedded we don't recognise them as assumptions at all. Although the details change, it is remarkable how food cultures also become settled and fixed over the centuries. We have our Christmas feast, our pancakes and our Easter buns, long after the practical need for them has been erased by advances in agriculture. Long before and after Napoleon, supposedly, derided Britain for being a nation of shopkeepers, that is how commercial society was arranged. When the complexity scientist Peter Turchin began mathematically modelling historical processes, he noted that, even after revolutions, countries usually return to the same way of rule. Culture is persistent. While he is writing about political systems, I am struck by how much this is also true of our food traditions and habits. Cultural preferences, for meat over fish, for example, can continually bob up over hundreds, even thousands of years. Food cultures aren't invincible, however. One of the threads which emerges through this book is that the things we say we most prize, eating together, say, or good and local ingredients, are quite fragile in the face of more powerful economic or political expediency.
Both your books are narrated by Emma Gregory. Did you have any choice in picking the narrator?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They sent me a little clip of Emma's voice and said, you know, would you be happy? And, of course, Emma's a wonderful actor, you know, and I was absolutely thrilled. I love her voice. I could very happily spend, you know, be in her company for a long time. And she's done both of them. I've been really delighted.
Do you fancy doing it yourself?
I said to them, I will do it myself if it's going to make a massive difference to sales. And they went, no, it's not. So that was the answer.
Fantastic. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Nice questions.
Both Scoff and Stuffed by Penn Vogler are available in audio commercially.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Still to come on today's show, we'll be talking to Julian Baggini about his book How the World Eats, and we'll have The Books of Your Life from Gareth Brown, author of The Book of Doors. But for now, let's find two brand new books in the RNIB library.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books library. So here are two new gems. The new book from Billy Connolly is Rambling Man, My Life on the Road, which was donated by Two Roads from the Hachette Group.
When I was a wee boy, I felt like an outsider. I didn't fit in anywhere. On Sundays, when my father would take me and my sister to the markets, we'd walk a few miles back home, and on the way I used to go to the litter bins by the side of the bus stops and fish out the cigarette packets. I would take the silver paper out of it and roll it together until I had a big ball of it. I was in the Cub Scouts, so I took it to them hoping to get my charity badge by selling my ball as scrap and giving the money to charity. But I never got that badge. The woman in charge said, you can't just make one ball and expect to get your badge. You have to save up a lot of balls. I had fallen short again. I thought, I'll do something else then. I decided to ask people for their broken jewellery so I could make something out of it. But I never got round to that either. I was a failure at most things I tried. My whole life has been like that. As a boy, I could never follow the established rules and paths that could lead to the kind of success other boys achieved. I never joined a cycling club. I never joined a hiking club or a camping club. I knew I wouldn't fit in. I knew that when I got among other members, I wouldn't do what you're supposed to do to get the prizes. I'd be a flop.
When Billy set out from Glasgow as a young man, he never looked back. He played his banjo on boats and trains, under trees and on top of famous monuments. He danced naked in snow, wind and fire. He slept in bus stations, under bridges and on stranger floors. He travelled by foot, bike, ship, plane, sleigh, even piggybacked, to get to his next destination. Billy has wandered to every corner of the earth and believes that being a rambling man is about more than just travelling, it's a state of mind. Rambling men and women are free spirits who live on their wits, are interested in people and endlessly curious about the world. They love to play music, make art, or tell stories along the way. But above all, they have a longing in their heart for the open road. In his joyful new book, Billy explores this philosophy and how it has shaped him, and he shares hilarious new stories from his lifetime on the road. Rambling Man is a truly global adventure with the greatest possible travel companion.
One thing that made me feel less of an outsider was to be alone on the road. I'd leave the house and just start walking. I would go along the main street and see where it led me. I'd see the canal winding ahead, so I'd follow that for a while, wishing I had my fishing rod. I'd pass the Singer sewing machine factory and other places I'd seen before. I felt perfectly comfortable just walking by myself. I was on my own at last, and I felt enormously relieved. I realised that if I fitted in anywhere in the world, it was here, just rambling to nowhere in particular. I walked the streets, graveyards and parks. I've always liked graveyards. I'd read the headstones and wonder who those people were. Hairy Mary used to say hello to me. She was an old lady I'd often seen on the street. When I was coming to her corner, she would say, "Well," and stand on her hands. Her skirt would fall over her head so you can see her old knickers. But her hat always stayed on. She was a wild woman of the streets, and I was proud that she knew me. She'd say, "Hello, son." I'd say, "Hello. How you doing, Mary?" She'd say, "I'm not Mary. They just call me Mary. Hairy Mary," I'd say. "What's your real name?" She'd say, "None of your business." She was always angry, and I loved her for it. She wandered the streets the same as me. She never said, "Aren't you a bit young to be wandering about on your own?" like other adults did. I'd say, "Where do you live?" "None of your business." "Okay." But it was obvious she lived on the street. She was always complaining about people who had moved her on. "I don't like that janitor." I never worried about getting lost. Nobody's ever really lost. You just walk until you become unlost. I walked in Kelvin Grove Park and then to Victoria Park, where miniature yachts were sailing on the pond. Beautiful things, huge. They'd set them out to sail, then run round and turn them onto another tack. An owl lived in Victoria Park in a cave. I'd peer in and look at it and it would stare back. And there were petrified trees from the Stone Age. I would just sit there among them. I felt calm. I never wanted to go home. But when it got near dinner time, I'd start heading back. Because if I didn't turn up for dinner time, they'd realise I was missing.
Rambling Man, My Life on the Road by Billy Connolly is read by Billy Connolly and lasts for 7 hours and 56 minutes.
Penguin Random House has donated this brand new thriller. Death at the Sanitarium is by Ragnar Johansson.
The despairing silence was broken. There was someone at the front door, knocking loudly. Helgi got to his feet. He had been sitting on the sofa with a detective novel, trying to calm himself down before bed by losing himself in a fictional world. But now the piece was over. He and Bergthora rented a basement flat in an old house not far from Reykjavik's Laugardalur area. The whole house was rented out, the flat upstairs occupied by a couple with two children. Apparently, the landlord lived overseas. Helgi didn't get on particularly well with the other tenants, who had a tendency to be rude and interfering, as if their rights took precedence just because they lived in the larger half of the house. As a result, Relations between the basement and upstairs were strictly limited, and frosty at best.
Akureyri, Northern Iceland, 1983. High up in the most northern part of Iceland stands the Akureyri Sanatorium. Once a hospital dedicated to treating tuberculosis, it now sits haunted by the ghosts of its past. One wing of the hospital remains open and houses six employees, the caretaker, two doctors, two nurses, and a young research assistant. Despite the wards closing decades ago, they remain at the hospital to conduct research. But the cold corridors, drafty windows, and echoey halls are constant reminders of the building's dark history. When one of the nurses, Irsa, is found brutally murdered, they discover that death has never left this place, and neither did its secrets. None can escape this terrifying legacy. Despite just five suspects, the case is never solved and remains open for two decades, until a young criminologist named Helgi Rikdal attempts to finally lay the ghosts of the hospital's past to rest.
Helgi was afraid it was the neighbour at the door now, sticking his nose in yet again. But there was another, worse possibility. He moved reluctantly towards the hall. The sitting room was cosy, the walls lined from floor to ceiling with books. His books. A comfy armchair by the shelves and a decent-sized sofa in front of the television. There were scented candles on the coffee table, but Helgi hadn't lit them. Not this time. He'd put a record on the stereo, though. A real, vinyl one. The stereo was new and connected up to the home cinema, but the records he played were old jazz LPs that had belonged to his father. The heavy banging on the front door broke through the soothing music, wrecking the tranquil atmosphere that had settled over the flat. Hell, Helgi thought. He had reached the hall when there was another round of hammering, even louder this time. He drew a sharp breath, then took hold of the handle, pausing briefly to collect himself, before he turned the latch and opened the door. Outside stood a uniformed police officer, a broad-shouldered young man in his mid-twenties, with strong features. He was standing in the glow of the outside light, brightly illuminated in the evening darkness, wearing a look of grim determination, as if he were anticipating a fight. Helgi didn't recognize him. In the shadows, a little behind him, stood another officer. He seemed more at his ease, judging by his stance, though Helgi couldn't make out his face. "Good evening," said the illuminated officer. His voice wasn't as authoritative as Helgi had been expecting. In fact, he thought he detected a faint tremor. Perhaps the determined set of the man's features was just a ploy to disguise his nerves. Perhaps it was his first shift. "Helgi? Helgi Rekdal?" Although Helgi, now in his early 30s, wasn't that much older than the man asking his name, he sensed he had the advantage over this young officer. "Helgi Rekdal, yes, that's right. Why? What's up?" he asked smoothly, shifting the balance of power slightly. "We've received, that's to say," the young policeman hesitated, as Helgi had guessed he might. A complaint has been received," Helgi interrupted. "A complaint? Who from?" He wasn't going to let himself appear flustered.
Death at the Sanatorium by Ragnar Johansson is read by Sam Wolfe and runs for 6 hours 41 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Murder Under the Sun, written by Agatha Christie.
The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Brazil by Michael Palin.
Every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. enjoy a classic from the RNIB Talking Books Library.
Black Beauty by Anna Sewell.
Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte.
Plus, you can enjoy A Book for the Younger Listener or Young at Heart every Saturday at 9 a.m. with a repeat on Sundays at 3 p.m. and Tuesdays at 6 p.m.
Alice's Adventures in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll.
Anne of Green Gables by L.M. Montgomery.
Enjoy your favourite talking books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
And finally, in our little food trifecta, let's hear from philosopher Julien Bagini. He was at Wigtown to talk about his book, How the World Eats, a global food philosophy. How we live is shaped by how we eat. You can see this in the vastly different approaches to growing, preparing and eating food around the world, such as the hunter-gatherer Hadza, whose sustainable lifestyle is under threat in a crowded planet, or the Western societies where food is farmed or bred in vast, intensive enterprises. Most of us now rely on a global food web of production, distribution, consumption and disposal, which is now contending with unprecedented challenges. So how can we build a global food system that works for us all? Now, at this point, I would throw to a clip of the audio version, which has been read by Julien Bagini himself. But at the time of recording, it's not coming out for another month or so. So I'm going to dive into the RNIB Talking Books Library and look at Julien's back catalogue. One book that we did speak about at Wigtown was The Pig That Wants to be Eaten. The author presents 100 thought experiments which pose a problem in a vivid and concrete way and invites the reader to think about the possible answers for themselves. Experiments cover identity, religion, art, ethics, language, knowledge, and many more. And Julien offers some ways of approaching each problem. The audio version of The Pig That Wants to be Eaten by Julien Bagini is read by Tom Lawrence.
Imagination without reason is mere fancy, but reason without imagination is sterile. That is partly why scientists and philosophers alike have always used imaginary scenarios to help sharpen their ideas and push them to their limits. The purpose of such thought experiments is to strip away the things that complicate matters in real life, in order to focus clearly on the essence of a problem. So, for example, a real-life ethical dilemma will always be complicated by contingent, context-specific factors. Take the general issue of whether eating meat is morally wrong. If you consider whether it is wrong to eat the meat you have an opportunity to consume, multiple factors come into play. Some animals will have been factory-farmed, some humanely reared, some caught wild. Some animals will have been raised on land that was once rainforest, others will have freely grazed on open pastures. Some meat will be organic, some will be genetically modified, some will have been shipped from the other side of the world. Deciding the ethical rights and wrongs requires untangling all these multiple factors and weighing up the different considerations accordingly. Thought experiments can help because, like scientific experiments, they aim to isolate the key variables, the specific factors under examination, to see what difference they, and they alone, make to our understanding of the world. So if we want to consider the ethics of eating animals, we can imagine situations in which the particular issue of concern is the only one to differ between two scenarios. If we're worried about how we treat farm animals, let us imagine what difference good treatment and good treatment alone makes. If our intentions are under scrutiny, we can ask what difference does it make if the chicken in your Kiev died in an accident, whereas mine had its neck wrung intentionally, but before that they had lived identical lives. We can simply stipulate that all other things are equal, so the only question we need to settle is the core moral one. Thought experiments do not just have the advantage of being tidier than real life. They can actually help us think about things that we could or would not test in real life. Sometimes they require us to imagine what is impractical or even impossible, either for us right now or for all people at all times. Although what these experiments ask us to consider can seem outlandish, the purpose is the same as for any thought experiment, to keep our focus on one core concept or problem. If an impossible scenario helps us do that, then its impossibility need not concern us. The experiment is merely a tool to aid our thinking. It does not pretend to describe actual life.
A clip of Julian Baggini's The Pig Who Wants to Be Eaten, one of many books by him in the RNIB Talking Books Library. Julian was at the Wigtown Book Festival to talk about his book, How the World Eats, A Global Food Philosophy.
The book is really trying to look at the various facets of the food system, including across the globe and across time. So we're looking at like complete food systems of the past, like hunter-gathering, or the pastoralism that you found in places like East Africa, to subsistence farming, to modern industrialised agriculture, but also looking at aspects of food systems such as aquaculture, which is fish farming, packaging, distribution, commodification, ultra-processing of food, all these things. So it's like 17. There are 17 chapters, and it's like the Ten Commandments. I can never get all of them out from memory. I always have to look up a few.
It's a huge system, but is it fundamentally broken?
Yeah, yes, that's true. And there's a lot of disagreement about the food system. But most people think it is fundamentally broken because it's unsustainable from an environmental and economic point of view. It's not succeeding in nourishing people properly. Huge amounts of people just simply aren't getting enough food, and a lot of other people are getting the wrong kind of food. And so it's totally unsustainable, and we need to fix it. So one of the things, although there's 17 chapters, each have a different focus, there's also an objective to try and extract from all these things what are the recurring positive principles on which a proper food system can be based.
You mentioned malnutrition there, but you gave quite a startling statistic that I think I'm right in saying there are more people dying of being overweight than underweight.
Yeah, well, I think the actual way they put it is that there are more people living in countries where being overweight is a greater cause of death than in countries where being underweight is a greater cause of death. So, yeah, it is quite extraordinary. And the other thing is, undernutrition and obesity are things which you sometimes see together. There are places in the world where people are undernourished in the sense that they don't have enough of the appropriate nutrients, and yet they're also overweight. That's because they're relying on a lot of cheap grains and not much else, which are putting on the pounds but not giving them the nutrition they need.
How soon will it be until we can go into the supermarket and buy lab-grown meat?
I wouldn't want to bet a sum I was not prepared to lose on this, but my hunch, my general impression is say do not hold your breath, because we get lots of gushy stuff about the research, and when you dig into it, what you almost always find is that these people are not close to having a commercial product. And when you dig into it, and I sort of read various things about this, the obstacles to it being commercially viable are huge. One of the most optimistic studies into this, which was funded by an organisation which is pro this kind of technology, concluded, if you really broke it down carefully behind the headlines, that even on their most optimistic scenarios, the kind of thing they were talking about would be considerably more expensive than lean steak. And it wouldn't be lean steak, it would be this sort of slurry which you would mash into burgers and things. So, it would be fantastic if the claims of this industry were true, but I'm suspicious.
Now, we've got many of your books in audio in the RNIB Talking Books Library with a few different narrators, but it seems like recently you've started narrating them yourself. How has that been?
Yeah, no, it's a learning curve. I wanted to do it because I heard a few snippets of other ones, and I didn't like it because when you're talking about non-fiction, I mean, these actors are very good actors, but the point about non-fiction is that, where you put the emphasis in a sentence is quite important to the meaning, right? And this is something people who read, blind people are probably more aware of this because they rely more on hearing than reading. They're more sensitive to the importance of intonation. And so I wanted to read it myself so it could actually carry the meaning which I had for it. Now, I'm not a professional actor, so that has its problems, but it seemed to work because the point is I did one, and then ever since I've been able to do another one, so they must be happy with the results. And it's also one of the practice makes perfect. I think the last recording was the one I felt happiest with. So hopefully it's good.
And just finally, one of the books that we have in the library is The Pig Who Wants to Be Eaten. Give us a thought experiment that can be done with or without sight.
Okay. Well, actually, this is there's one thought experiment which is highly relevant to people without sight. So you're to imagine that there is a scientist who has studied everything about redness and the perception of red. But the point is that they are themselves entirely, they only see in monochrome, they only see in black and white. So they've never seen red. They know everything there is to know about redness and how it's perceived, if they were to suddenly were to be able to perceive the whole colour spectrum, would they gain a new piece of knowledge? That's the puzzle. And I won't even suggest answers, but think about it for yourself. Do they know? They obviously have a new experience, but have they gained knowledge? Is there something they? In other words, is there something you can only know through direct experience?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Julian Baggini's How the World Eats, A Global Food Philosophy, will be out in audio, as read by Julian himself, very soon. But for now, here's another clip from The Pig Who Wants to be Eaten, which, as a Star Trek fan, I found this thought experiment very interesting.
Beam me up. For Stelios, the teletransporter is the only way to travel. Previously, it took months to get from the Earth to Mars, confined to a cramped spacecraft with a far-from-perfect safety record. Stelios's Teletransport Express changed all that. Now the trip takes just minutes, and so far it has been 100% safe. However, now he is facing a lawsuit from a disgruntled customer who is claiming the company actually killed him. His argument is simple. The teletransporter works by scanning your brain and body, cell by cell, destroying them, beaming the information to Mars, and reconstructing you there. Although the person on Mars looks, feels, and thinks just like a person who has been sent to sleep and zapped across space, the claimant argues that what actually happens is that you are murdered and replaced by a clone. To Stelios, this sounds absurd. After all, he has taken the teletransporter trip dozens of times, and he doesn't feel dead. Indeed, how can the claimant seriously believe that he has been killed by the process when he is clearly able to take the case to court? Still, as Stelios entered the teletransporter booth once again and prepared to press the button that would begin to dismantle him, he did, for a second, wonder whether he was about to commit suicide.
Thanks again to Julian Baggini. His book, How the World Eats, should be out in audio in a few weeks' time.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
And finally, on today's show. Well, last week's show was a talk featuring Gareth Brown and the Book of Doors, but we didn't have time for the books of his life. First of all, I asked him about his time at Wigtown.
Oh, it was great. Lovely to see so many people here. First time in Wigtown as well, so it's really nice to come to the book festival and some really interesting questions as well. Enjoyed it.
Now, we'll do a section of the show called Books of Your Life. So, is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
I didn't actually read a lot of books when I was younger. What I used to love when I was a child was I would read Asterix comics. The Asterix, the Gaul and Obelisk. I used to read those a lot. I'd go down to our local library in Bowness where I grew up and I'd try to read them all because there was a whole collection. But I wasn't much of a reader really until I was a teenager when I started reading horror books by Stephen King. That was my gateway drug into literature. But as a child, it was comics more than books.
If you were to pick one Stephen King, because we can play a clip of Asterix, but if you were to pick one Stephen King, what one would it be?
Well, the book that got me into reading was Christine, but if I was to pick one on merit, I would probably say maybe The Dead Zone. That's probably one of his better, earlier books.
The two things Sarah remembered about that night later were his run of luck at the Wheel of Fortune and the mask. But as time passed, years of it, it was the mask she thought about, when she could bring herself to think about that horrible night at all. He lived in an apartment house in Cleves Mills. Sarah got there at 7:45, parking around the corner and buzzing up to be let in. They were taking her car tonight, because Johnny's was laid up at Tibbetts Garage in Hampton with a frozen wheel bearing or something like that. Something expensive, Johnny had told her over the phone, and then he had laughed a typical Johnny Smith laugh. Sarah would have been in tears if it had been her car, her pocketbook. Sarah went through the foyer to the stairs, past the bulletin board that hung there. It was dotted with file cards advertising motorbikes, stereo components, typing services, and appeals from people who needed rides to Kansas or California, people who were driving to Florida and needed riders to share the driving and help pay for the gas. But tonight the board was dominated by a large placard showing a clenched fist against an angry red background suggesting fire. The one word on the poster was strike. It was late October of 1970.
That's Lorelei King reading From the Dead Zone by Stephen King, available from RNIB Talking Books.
And is there a book on a rainy day you could happily cuddle up with and reread?
I love thrillers, and I love, at the moment, I've read a lot of Lee Child books, so I would quite happily reread one of the early Lee Child books just as an easy, mindless sort of read. Very entertaining.
I was arrested in Eno's Diner at 12 o'clock. I was eating eggs and drinking coffee. A late breakfast, not lunch. I was wet and tired after a long walk in heavy rain, all the way from the highway to the edge of town. The diner was small but bright and clean, brand new, built to resemble a converted railroad car. Narrow, with a long lunch counter on one side and a kitchen bumped out back. Booths lining the opposite wall. A door where the center booth would be. I was in a booth at a window reading somebody's abandoned newspaper about the campaign for a president I didn't vote for last time and wasn't going to vote for this time. Outside, the rain had stopped, but the glass was still pebbled with bright drops. I saw the police cruisers pull in the gravel lot. They were moving fast and crunched to a stop. Light bars flashing and popping. Red and blue light in the raindrops on my window. Doors burst open, policemen jumped out. Two from each car, weapons ready. Two revolvers, two shotguns. This was heavy stuff. One revolver and one shotgun ran to the back. One of each rushed the door. I just sat and watched them. I knew who was in the diner. A cook in back, two waitresses, two old men, and me. This operation was for me. I'd been in town less than half an hour. The other five had probably been here all their lives. Any problem with any of them, and an embarrassed sergeant would have shuffled in. He would be apologetic. He would mumble to them. He would ask them to come down to the station house. So the heavy weapons and the rush weren't for any of them. They were for me. I crammed egg into my mouth and trapped a five under the plate, folded the abandoned newspaper into a square and shoved it in my coat pocket, kept my hands above the table and drained my cup. The guy with the revolver stayed at the door. He went into a crouch and pointed the weapon two-handed, at my head. The guy with the shotgun approached close. They were fit, lean boys, neat and tidy. Textbook moves. The revolver at the door could cover the room with a degree of accuracy. The shotgun up close could splatter me all over the window. The other way around would be a mistake. The revolver could miss in a close-quarter struggle, and a long-range shotgun blast from the door would kill the arresting officer and the old guy in the rear booth as well as me. So far they were doing it right. No doubt about that. They had the advantage. No doubt about that either. The tight booth trapped me. I was too hemmed in to do much. I spread my hands on the table. The officer with the shotgun came near. "Freeze! Police!" he screamed. He was screaming as loud as he could, blowing off his tension and trying to scare me. Textbook moves. Plenty of sound and fury to soften the target. I raised my hands. The guy with the revolver started in from the door. The guy with the shotgun came closer. Too close. Their first error. If I had to, I might have lunged for the shotgun barrel and forced it up. A blast into the ceiling, perhaps, and an elbow into the policeman's face, and the shotgun could have been mine. The guy with the revolver had narrowed his angle and couldn't risk hitting his partner. It could have ended badly for them. But I just sat there, hands raised. The guy with the shotgun was still screaming and jumping. "Out here on the floor!" he yelled. I slid slowly out of the booth and extended my wrist to the officer with the revolver. I wasn't going to lie on the floor. Not for these country boys. Not if they brought along their whole police department with howitzers.
That's Jay Benedict reading from Killing Floor, Jack Reacher Book 1 by Lee Child, available in the RNIB Library.
And is there something you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently, it's fresh in the mind, you'd like to recommend.
One of the books I read earlier this year was a book called The Book Eaters by Sunny Dean, which is a sort of a modern sort of horror fairy tale set in the real world, a spin on vampires, so instead of drinking blood, they eat books. That was a really, really interesting book.
These days, Devon only bought three things from the shops. Books, booze, and Sensitive Care skin cream. The books she ate, the booze kept her sane, and the lotion was for Kai, her son. He suffered occasionally from eczema, especially in winter. There were no books in this convenience store, only rows of garish magazines. Not to her taste, and anyway, she had enough books to eat at home. Her gaze skipped across the soft porn, power tools and home living publications down to the lower strata, where children's magazines glowed pink and yellow. Devon ran short, ragged nails across the covers. She thought about buying one for Kai, because he seemed to like reading that kind of thing at the moment, and decided against it. After tonight, his preferences might change. She walked to the end of the aisle, linoleum squishing beneath her heel boots, and set her basket at the checkout. Four bottles of vodka and a tub of skin cream. The cashier looked at the basket, then back at her. Do you have ID? Pardon? Do you have any ID? He repeated slowly, as if to someone hard of hearing. She stared. I'm 29. I looked every year of it too. He shrugged, crossed his arms, waiting. Wasn't much more than a kid himself. At most 18 or 19, working in the family shop and likely trying to follow all the rules. Understandable, but she couldn't oblige him. Devon didn't have any ID. No birth certificate, no passport, no driver's licence, nothing. Officially, she didn't exist.
The book Eaters by Sunny Dean is available from RNIB Libraries, as read by Katie Erich. Thanks again to Gareth Brown. You can hear his talk on his book, The Book of Doors, in last week's show, Read On number 393. And we'll have more from the Wigtown Book Festival at the same time next week.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.